Good morning. My name is Mark Shearer. I'm from Independence, Missouri, in the World Church Headquarters. I'm the church historian for the Community of Christ, and I'll be chairing your session this morning. Number 213, how important are political candidates' religious beliefs? I've been advised to remind you that it would be very appropriate to silence your cell phones and any other noise makers or rotten tomatoes or anything else that you might have.
That's what this is for, me to hide behind that.
Okay. And also, I've been asked to plug the book sales. And if it's possible for you to stop by, Sunstone earns a percentage from benchmark books. So if you have opportunity to visit the room there, it would be very, very appropriate and greatly appreciated. I'd like to introduce Bill Russell. He is the Emeritus Professor of History, American History, Religion, and Politics at Graceland University, Lamoni, Iowa. Bill is obviously well known to everybody at Sunstone. Certainly he is at Mormon History Association and John Whitmer Historical Association, serving as president of both organizations. Bill is widely published. His Treasure in Earthen Vessels, an Introduction to the New Testament, published by Herald Publishing Company in 1966, for many has been the definitive work on the subject. Bill's most recent book is Homosexual Saints, The Community of Christ Experience. He is also working on two other books, a very prolific writer, researcher. The first one is Schisms, Splintering, and Re-Identification, a book on schisms within the movement. And the second is on the Jeffrey Lindgren murders, titled Repent or Be Destroyed, the 1989 murders in Kirtland, Ohio. Bill reminds me that he has published in articles and reviews in every single Mormon Studies publication, with one exception, the Nauvoo Expositor. He didn't do that one. I'm sorry. He didn't, we almost got
they didn't even answer my letter.
Okay. What's with those people anyway? Okay. Bill has been a political activist for half a century. He writes a political column that I receive. It goes to the Lamoni Chronicle, which is the local newspaper there, but he sends it out to more than 200 people over the internet, and my guess is that there are people here who receive it as well. He has been an observer of politics and has taught American government at Graceland certainly over the last 40 years, including his retirement years. Last semester it was a course on political parties, and this fall he will teach constitutional law. A little bit about Bill. Bill received a Bachelor of Arts degree in religion from Graceland in 1960. He received a Master's of Divinity from St. Paul's School of Theology in Kansas City, a very excellent, excellent Methodist seminary. In 1967, he received that degree. He received his Juris Doctor from the University of Iowa in 1976. It's been my great pleasure to be with Bill over the last several days. We made the two-day drive out here from Lamoni, Iowa. I left Independence about 5 minutes after 5 o'clock on Tuesday, made it to Lamoni, and on my way, what could we possibly talk about all the way on the two-day drive? Well, productive discussions all. Between Lamoni and Grand Island, Nebraska, on Interstate 80, we found an accommodation between Republicans and Democrats. It was amazing. We just, in our conversations, there's harmony in Congress, thanks to our conversations. Between Grand Island and Cheyenne, Wyoming, we resolved the fiscal crisis in the nation. Between Cheyenne and Laramie, we've solved the debt crisis, the national debt crisis. All done. And finally, between Laramie and Salt Lake City, we accurately predicted every single race in the presidential election forthcoming. Our return trip home, I want you to know, we will solve the Middle East crisis and the China debt issue, and somewhere from western Nebraska to Lamoni will no doubt involve long periods of silence, because we will solve the entire problems of the world by that time. Anyway, I'm sorry. The notebook spot. I've talked to William Law and watch for it. Okay. Okay. I think you'll enjoy this morning's presentation. I give you Bill Russell. Okay.
Now, Mark, I know where you live, and if you left at 5 after 5 and got to my house sort out after 7 like you did, I know you broke the law significantly.
Yeah. Probably so.
I wouldn't have done it that quickly. Did they check the security clearance on this fellow right back here? He snuck in. Okay.
Don't
take
you away.
Yeah. last time I flew out to Salt Lake City, it was very interesting. I was sitting on the aisle, and right next to me was an elder. I never found out whether it was an LDS elder, Community of Christ. I didn't butt into the conversation, or Remnant Church, or Fundamentalist Mormon, or whatever. But they were talking away, and then along came the flight attendant to take their drinks, and the priest ordered a glass of wine. So the elder said, isn't it inappropriate for a man of the cloth to be drinking alcoholic beverages, drinking wine, specifically wine? And the priest said, well, Jesus drank wine. And the elder said, well, yes, I know, but I would have thought more highly of him if he hadn't. So. Anyway, when the founding fathers gathered in Philadelphia in 1787, they were well aware that for about 14 centuries in the Western world, religion was controlled to a significant extent government. Religion was controlled to a significant extent by government. Established churches. In Europe, it was common to have an established church everywhere, Catholic or various Eastern Orthodox churches or Protestant churches after the Reformation. In the British colonies that became the United States, 9 of the 13 colonies, I always make a face at Stephen comes in, but he's never quick enough to catch it. 9 of the 13 colonies had established churches. New England colonies had congregational Puritan establishments, while Southern colonies had Anglican establishments. That is, the Church of England. Traditionally, these establishments of religion were thought to be necessary for the security of society. Possibly the two greatest advocates for the separation of church and state were Roger Williams in the 17th century Puritan and Thomas Jefferson of the revolutionary generation more than a century later. But their views were quite different. Williams wanted church and state to be separate because he wanted to protect the church against the corrupting power of the state. Jefferson wanted to protect the state from the corrupting power of the church. Jefferson said he frequently reread his friend Joseph Priestley's two-volume book, The History of the Corruptions of Christianity. I would suggest that Jefferson and Priestley's ideas about Catholic Church corruption influenced the thinking of a lot of Americans, including Joseph Smith. It seems to me that some of these ideas found their way into the Book of Mormon, especially the part about the great and abominable church, the whore of all the earth. You might have heard about that one. If not from the Book of Mormon itself, then maybe from Bruce McConkie. Some people active in politics and political punditry these days have been suggesting that the United States is a Christian nation and claim that the founding fathers wanted it that way. It is only true in the sense that practically everybody who professed some religion was Christian, and which meant Protestant, because there was only about 1% who were Catholic or Jewish, and they weren't exactly considered first-class citizens. The problem for those who think the United States is a Christian nation is that the Constitution has only one reference to religion, and that's negative. Article 6 says no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. So that covers elective or appointed offices. The founding fathers didn't believe that people of any particular religious perspective should be prevented from public office or privileged with regard to obtaining selection to public office. Now, most of our founding fathers wanted to change direction and have a secular government. My favorite bumper sticker in the Mona is from Bill Moraine. Some of you know him. And it says, pray for a secular government. they want a secular government, not a government that gave official preference for Christians or any particular brand of Christians. No matter what you might hear today from those on the religious right who deny that the Constitution calls for a separation of government and religion. Many men of influence were not happy that the proposed national constitution had no Bill of Rights. So to satisfy that need for more fundamental rights in the Constitution, by 1791, Congress and the states had completed the ratification of the first 10 amendments of the Constitution. Only the First Amendment deals with religion. Maybe it's because religion is the most important. Maybe not. But anyway, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So there's two important religious ideas here. There should be no establishments of religion. No church is going to be favored. But secondly, on the other side of the coin, we are guaranteed the free exercise of religion. I teach constitutional law, and sometimes there'll be cases where there's really a conflict between those two clauses. No establishment of religion means that the government cannot give official preference for one religion over another. Now, you might tell your religious right or Tea Party friends that that means the government cannot prefer Christianity over Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, or atheism for that matter. And so we're not a Christian nation. The other guarantee of the free exercise of religion, that is of the free exercise of religion, means all people are free to choose their own religious beliefs and practice, or to choose no religious belief or practice at all. The free exercise of religion meant freedom from religion as well as freedom of religion. My most recent textbook change the old chapter heading of freedom of religion to freedom of and from religion. I think that's quite appropriate. It's interesting that the first case on free exercise of religion to come to the Supreme Court was Reynolds versus the United States, a case that 1879, a case you are all familiar with. And the court held that basically have the right to believe any damn fool thing you want. But if you're going to act upon that, then if it's a serious threat to society, then the law can outlaw it. So, yeah, polygamy, of course, in the late 19th century was that kind of a threat, not so much anymore. These 10 amendments only applied to the national government first, and not to the state governments. And Reynolds versus the United States was a federal case in the territories. But then in the 20th century, the Supreme Court began to apply them to the states, because the 14th Amendment after the Civil War stated, no state, they're trying to make the states have to grant us basic freedoms, no state should deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So several states retained established churches, going back now to the century, several states retained established churches after the new government was formed in 1789. It was not until 1833 that all of the established churches had lost their special status and were disestablished. Lyman Beecher, famous Connecticut congregational minister, his daughter said that when the congregational church was disestablished by the government in Connecticut in 1819, he was so desolate about it. She said he had his head on the table, kitchen table, and virtually crying. And he was thinking it was the end of the church. We'll never survive without government aid. But about a decade later or so, Lyman Beecher realized, yeah, I guess we can do that maybe a little better without government aid. Now, moving into the 20th century, although there was no religious test of any federal office, until 1960, every president was a white male Protestant, at least in name anyway. And John Kennedy is still the only Catholic ever to hold the highest office in the land, even though Catholicism is, for quite a while, for more than a century, has been the largest denomination in America by far. As of today, we've had 43 Protestants and one Catholic president. Oh, wait, I forgot. We have a Muslim president right now, so I'm not bad on that.
John McCain would say, no, that's not right.
Yeah, thanks, John. I got that. Kennedy needed to assure the American people that he would not be taking orders from the Pope or the Bishop, Archbishop or whatever. any Catholic official. So he goes to Houston, you know, the heart of, maybe it's kind of the heart of Baptist country anyway, not the Bible country. He went to the Ministerial Alliance there, and of course gave that classic speech, which you probably heard or read, reassuring these men of the cloth, they say most of whom were Baptists, that he would keep church and state separate and act only in the interest of the American people. Now, Kennedy is not a very good Catholic, so that's really, that wasn't a danger. But Gene McCarthy later, you know, was a Catholic running for president. He was a good Catholic, but he did not appreciate the fact that John Kennedy was not. But now, anyway, I didn't ask you about this ahead of time, Father, I'm sure, but is now a good time to confess my sins?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
My father, when I was 20 years old, I cast my first vote as an adult, and just in the presidential election because I'd moved to Missouri and I couldn't vote. But in that election, I cast my ballot for Richard Milhouse Nixon simply because John F. Kennedy was Catholic. And the reason for that was the Russells were from Northern Ireland. I inherited a very strong anti-Catholic bias. My two older brothers were older, more wiser, and they voted for Kennedy. But now keep retain yourself because you got to hear my confessions.
I know. 50, I'm struggling. I'm struggling.
52 years. This has weighed on me. And so I'd like to confess that sin of racial bigotry, of religious bigotry.
Say five Hail Obamas and you'll be absolved.
Oh, that would be easy. That would be. Didn't have to write it down. So it's always good for the soul, and it's a real relief after all these years. There's two theories of the relationship between church and state. And these two theories are opposite of each other in a way. First is the idea of a strict separation of church and state. And then the accommodationist view is the second view. And that is that, you could call it the moderate view, you could call it the pragmatic view, but anyway, it's not a strict separation. And in the accommodationist view, you look at that first, it denies that there's a strict separation of church and state, and regards it as more of a pragmatic question. As long as the government is not favoring one religion over another, there is no establishment of religion violating the First Amendment. Thus, we can have income tax breaks for ministers, since ministers of all faiths get to take advantage of it. They all receive the same benefit, but strict separationists think that's an establishment of religion, and therefore unconstitutional. Now, for 50 years, 51, 52 years, I've benefited from that position because I was an editor of the church publishing house and then taught religion at Graceland, and all the faculty at Graceland that were ordained in the RLDS church unit as deacon got this ministerial tax benefit.
That's right.
It's probably unconstitutional.
No, well,
but I sure have enjoyed it. the great American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, one of my stars in theology, held the accommodationist view. And he stressed the idea that the church and state had to be independent of each other. There did not have to be a strict separation. And not to the strict separationist view. Of all the major, and this is interesting looking back, as if you haven't followed it, it's probably surprising you, but of all the major American denominations, the Baptists were the strongest supporters of the strict separation of church and state over the years until a generation ago, from the beginnings in America until recently. This is seen in the fact that they were the strongest supporters of the controversial Supreme Court decisions on prayer and Bible reading in 1962 and 63. I was an editor at our church publishing house. I read the releases every day from the Religious News Service and Catholics, and even Reinhold Niebuhr. Many were very critical of the decision. The Baptists were strong supporters of the court's separation of church and state here. And so the court held that it's unconstitutional for public schools to require the reading of a prayer at the beginning of the school day, and then in the other case, required reading of at least 10 verses from the Holy Bible at the beginning of the school day. Both constituted an establishment of religion and therefore violated the Establishment Clause. Like I say, I was an editor, I read these releases, and I realized that the Baptists are the strongest supporters among the major denominations. And now, if you're going to read the Bible in the classroom, what Bible version are you going to use? Are you going to use the King James Version for Protestant Bible? It's a pretty lousy version. Sorry if I offended anybody. But the modern versions are far better than translations of the ancient texts. Are you going to use one of the Catholic versions? Are you going to, in Utah and in Independence, Missouri, are you going to use the Joseph Smith translation, which includes that awful destruction of Jesus' famous forgiveness on the cross statement, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do"? Joseph Smith destroys it by saying, adding a parenthetical note in his translation, meaning the soldiers, you know, were just doing their duty. He didn't really forgive the people really responsible for it. I think it's just terrible. As for the Baptists in the 1960s, many of whom, you know, supported these decisions, you might wonder, now, don't Baptists believe in prayer and Bible reading? It's precisely because they do believe in prayer and Bible reading seriously that they supported the court's decision. The government should not be writing prayers for children to utter, nor should the government dictate reading of the Bible for religious purposes. Now, that 22-word prayer is just meaningless. Almighty God, we thank Thee for our school and our teachers and our government and everything, and bless us as we study something. Amen. You know, it's not satisfied for a Catholic, for a Protestant, for a Baptist, for a Mormon, or anybody. So it's a pretty meaningless prayer. No wonder the Baptists didn't favor it being required. But the court did say in 63 that studying the Bible in an academic setting without indoctrination would not be unconstitutional. It's part of Western culture. It's very important. But I don't think that's... Anybody ever hear of that being done in public schools? Okay. Well, good. You know, it's handled right, and it should be... It's an important subject. But why were the Baptists the strongest supporters of church-state separation? They had been outsiders in America. It was President Thomas Jefferson who first used the term separation of church and state. It's not in the Constitution. It's right, it's right. But just read the meaning of the Constitution and see it is a separation. But anyway, he's the first one to use, that we know of, to use that expression in an 1803 letter to the Danbury Baptists in Connecticut. Now, Connecticut still had the established church, the Congregational Church, and the Baptists were outsiders, always had been in America, or would have been in England too. They liked President Jefferson's support of the idea of separation of church and state. Now, Roger Williams, I guess they say he has some sort of connection with early American Baptists, although they're not clear about what all that is. But many Baptists' position on church and state separation have changed over the last 35 years. In the late 1970s, the rise of the religious right involved many Baptist ministers like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, who persuasively contended that evangelical Protestants ought to get involved in politics. The abortion issue has consistently been high on the list of the religious right political agenda. There have been several other significant hot-button issues on the agenda of the religious right, such as prayer in the public schools, scientific creationism, the latter being the idea that what amounted to the Genesis account of creation should be taught in public schools in addition to evolution, or instead of evolution, maybe, but they're not going to go with that. Can't get anywhere with that. An important issue for some religious right people was the Supreme Court's denial of the tax exemption for Bob Jones University because of their racially discriminatory policies that were crafted from their religious beliefs about racial segregation and white supremacy. Remember, many of the early religious right leaders like Jerry Falwell, and I think Robertson too, well, Robertson, were from the South, and like Falwell, had believed racial segregation was God's will with plenty of scriptural support. In the 1980 election, the religious right succeeded in playing an important role in the election of Ronald Reagan and the defeat of several liberal Democratic U.S. senators, including George McGovern and Iowa's own John Culver. And I think worst of all, from my perspective, Frank Church, and I had a great foreign relations guy, but he lost in that election. One reason for the organizational success of the religious right was that so many of the leaders had been independent Baptists. They weren't independent, they weren't American Baptists or Southern Baptists or General Assembly, regular Baptists or whatever, died in the world Baptists, whatever. They were independent Baptists. And they created and ran their own independent Baptist congregations. Now some were able to develop very large mega churches. That required political skills, the ability to appeal to a large audience, and the ability to raise money, lots of it. These skills could be transferred into the political arena. People obviously have the right to the free exercise of religion when deciding what candidates or parties to support. Article 6 merely means that the federal government cannot have religious tests for any office, like only Protestants can be president, which seemed to be the rule, anyway, the informal rule for a long time. Or Mormons not allowed. But we can apply any stupid religious test that we, when we vote, like my, I ain't going to vote for no Catholic because or refuse to vote for Romney because of his religion, or Obama because the Bible tells me blacks are created, are cursed by God. I got that idea straight from Elder McConkie's book. I suspect there are, sorry about my harangue against McConkie, I suspect there are more Americans who never would never vote for a black for president who, than who would never vote for a Mormon. People might disagree with that. But Romney will be hurt more by prejudice because so many who are anti-Mormon are Republicans. And most racists are going to vote Republican. They're never going to vote for Obama. They haven't voted for Democrats, most of them, a long time, since the Southern Strategy of Nixon. The real question is, should a candidate for public office campaign on a platform that includes positions derived from religious doctrine? And if elected, should she or he act on the basis of religious doctrine? Now, my position is very simple. If a candidate's position is based on her or his personal religious beliefs, it must be justified on the basis of the common good and not on religious dogma. It must be justified on secular grounds. And then secondly, a candidate's religion, religious beliefs, are fair game only if they could have an impact on how she, he or she will govern. In the election of 2012, we have had three examples of religious traditions today that are often in the news with regard to their positions on political issues based on their religious beliefs. Roman Catholics, religious right, the Mormons. The presidential candidacies of Al Smith in 1928 and John Kennedy in 1960, both Democrats, raised the issue of Roman Catholic theology, papal authority, and American politics. Rick Santorum this year renewed that discussion because he was clearly a good Catholic, but not in the modern sense, clearly in the pre-Vatican II sense, and maybe even in the, more of a medieval Catholic. maybe that's why he said the 1960 speech on religion by his fellow Catholic John Kennedy, Santorum said, when he read it, it made me want to vomit. Now, transubstantiation, that's what the Catholics believe. That's a doctrine that's pretty hard for us to get our minds around, but I can see no political relevance if a Catholic politician believes it. Now, I kind of doubt that John Kennedy did, but I wouldn't be surprised if Santorum does. But papal infallibility might fuel the kind of concern that many Americans had about John Kennedy. If the Pope is infallible and the politician is a good Catholic, like Santorum, can he be expected to follow church policy even if it seems contrary to the common good in America? Santorum's opposition to contraception and his belief that the teenage girl pregnant from rape should carry the fetus to full term, those are two good examples that might raise legitimate concerns in the political arena. Could such a policy be justified as being for the common good, especially the good of this rape victim? I mean, I just was horrified when I saw this. Just tell this blessing, this, bring this blessing in the world, you know, take care of the full term and have it adopted or whatever. But now let's look at the religious right. Many Baptists, Pentecostals, but certainly some Catholics and some Mormons adhere to this agenda as well. I think the most well-qualified religious right candidate in the last two elections is Mike Huckabee, governor of Arkansas for more than a decade. I mean, he had real political experience. These people this year, I think, were the poorest quality field ever to be fielded by either party, major party, in a presidential race. But anyway, Huckabee should have been examined with regard to whether his fundamentalist religious beliefs caused him to reject scientific conclusions regarding evolution, stem cell research, or global warming. I guess that's what it is. He should be questioned as to whether he accepts the patriarchal worldview of the Hebrew Bible and the later New Testament writings. I don't think Jesus and Paul fit here, but the later New Testament writings, where women were viewed as property. His Southern Baptist Convention holds that women should be submissive. Well, Huckabee should have been asked questions about that. If Huckabee believes every word of the Bible is true, he should be asked whether homosexuals should be put to death, along with about three dozen other crimes which the Bible prescribes the ultimate penalty, like violating the Sabbath, cursing your parents and so forth. We'd all be history if that was enforced. got some kind of a tickle in my throat today. A Catholic candidate had to ensure his constituency that she or he believes in gender equality, despite his church's denial of the priesthood to women. Santorum failed that test. A Mormon candidate should be asked the same question. Martin Luther, in rejecting the authority of tradition in Catholic theology, argued that the Bible is the only religious authority. For him, religious authority resides not in both tradition and scripture, as Catholics believe, but in scripture only, sola scriptura. He thought a lot of bad stuff had accumulated over the centuries. But Luther and Calvin and the other reformers were not fundamentalists who believed in biblical infallibility. Biblical infallibility is a 20th century American heresy. But this 20th century American heresy raises questions as to how a fundamentalist politician should handle issues relating to women, homosexuals, and maybe most importantly, or very importantly anyway, God's alleged support of mass murder and holy war. That is dangerous, and those religious issues are fair game for critical examination in the political arena. Now, I think most fundamentalist Protestants conveniently don't notice biblical doctrines that it's too foolish for any intelligent person to believe. In my view, whenever any book is seen as infallible, whenever any person is seen as infallible, the Pope or whoever, whether any institution or its leadership, our churches, is seen as infallible, we have serious problems. Everything and everybody, no matter how important or powerful, must be subjected to the same kind of critical scrutiny that we give secular subjects. Don't you think the parents of the boys that Jerry Sandusky molested would agree that no institution, not even Penn State football, should be above careful scrutiny? Okay, now let's look at the Mormons. According to Brinhurst and Foster in their book, The Mormon Quest for the Presidency, Mitt Romney was the 10th Mormon to run for president, and John Huntsman was number 11. In a session late tomorrow, they're going to include number 12 and 13, Rocky Anderson, Roseanne Barr. That's the real new one to me. But Mitt Romney in 2008 was the first Mormon where the public was exposed to serious questions about his religion. The other nine Mormons were either insignificant candidates who therefore didn't raise public concerns, they're not going to be president, or in the case of Mitt's father, Governor George Romney of Michigan, his Mormonism didn't become much of an issue because he differed with his church on the major domestic issue of the time, race, his church's priesthood denial on race. And he was a state president, for crying out loud, which wasn't lifted, of course, until 10 years after Romney's presidential race. The only other serious Mormon candidate was Mo Udall in 1976, but he was a Jack Mormon. Interestingly, I've read his press release. I was on his campaign in Iowa. He received letters from Mormons condemning him for being inactive and from non-Mormons condemning him for being a Mormon. So it was one of those lose-lose situations for him. Now, Orrin Hatch is a serious politician of national stature, but his candidacy in 2000 never got off the ground. Now, I met him three times in Iowa. He came to Grayson twice. And while I have huge differences with Hatch, I thought he's a better qualified candidate than Bush. But if you are a candidate who never polls above the lowest single digits, there's no need to attack your religion, or the media or the other candidates to attack your religion. Now, baptism of the dead. That might seem weird to the people outside the Mormon faith, but does that have any political implications? For us, it's just a waste of time. I see no political effect if Mitt Romney is a firm believer in the doctrine. And other doctrines that may seem weird if they don't seem to have any political implications. That's probably one reason why Mitt Romney doesn't want to talk about religion. He doesn't want to, these weird things, from the golden plates to polygamy and eternal progression and baptism of the dead. So he'd rather not talk about those, and I can certainly understand that. Now, I told a section yesterday that if I'm baptized after I die, I've got no complaints. I'm not like those Holocaust survivors. And I'm not a Holocaust survivor, so I can't speak for them. In fact, I respect their complaint about it. But if you do, fine. Because it turns out the LDS Church is the one true church of Jesus Christ and faith of the earth. You've done me a great favor. not, no harm done. So, no big deal. Okay, eternal progression to godhood. That's no problem unless the Mormon politician thinks he's already a god. And some non-Mormon politicians are already cursed with this disease, so it shouldn't be a big deal. I'm probably oversimplifying, but when I think of eternal progression to godhood, I think of my favorite line from Archie Bunker, and I hope you're not offended by this. Talking to his son-in-law, who he not so affectionately called Meathead, he said, "God don't make no mistakes, that's how you got to be God." I think that's just one of my all-time favorite Archie line. Archie was a great theologian. A political problem arises from the Book of Mormon's view of America as the chosen nation. American exceptionalism is a term we use now in a lot of our public discussion. It sounds like Manifest Destiny of the 1940s all over again. It seems like all politicians, including Obama, unfortunately, but I see why he does it, find it necessary to say we're better than any other country. We aren't. It makes me sick when I hear this, because I think this kind of arrogant nonsense makes us a danger in the world. Why don't we try humility for a while? I hear from my Mormon friends that in their wards, the Book of Mormon, and I'd be interested in hearing from you either at discussion or afterward, in their wards, the Book of Mormon is cited more than the Bible. That concerns me because Jesus, as understood by Joseph Smith when he wrote the Book of Mormon, is significantly different from the Jesus we see in the four Gospels. I much prefer Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. As first century disciples, they were much closer to the Christ event than a 19th century American prophet named Joseph Smith, who was affected by this 19th century American worldview when he wrote the Book of Mormon. Now, I'm never going to say Jesus said such and such unless it's from the four Gospels. You know, I really can't trust the 19th century Gospel of Jesus. It's seriously different from the four Gospels. I wonder how seriously Mitt Romney takes the Book of Mormon, however. When you get beyond all the wars and calamities in the book, you see that it's a populist protest against the powerful people in society who were oppressing ordinary people. I don't see any policy proposals to help the marginalized or the underprivileged in Romney's campaign or in any other Republican presidential campaigns. In fact, in those debates, I'm a glutton for punishment, I watched practically all 20 of them, whenever somebody had taken some humanitarian position in the past, like supporting the Dream Act, which I think is absolute, obvious, should be a go, the others, often led by Romney, would condemn him for it. I don't hear any concern for the little people in Romney. And I watched almost, like I said, I watched all the debates, practically. I think I missed one. And public servants were belittled during the campaign as, you know, they, public jobs aren't real jobs. Well, tell that to the school teachers, the police officers, the firefighters, and social workers and so forth that are paid for by government entities. In the interest of time, let's take a look at two political issues in the LDS Church, where the LDS Church has a clear position. Abortion. Before the rise of the religious right in the late 1970s, it was largely a Catholic issue, and they were taking the lead in opposing abortion. But then the religious right came along and became very polarized between the two parties. The Republicans were split on abortion before the religious right as well, but they had pushed them into a corner on that. And then, of course, the Supreme Court decision came in 73. It was a compromise decision, but obviously more acceptable to the pro-choice people. By the late 1970s, fall when other evangelical Protestants had got involved in the anti-abortion crusade, Catholics and Baptists were never close, but now they had an uneasy alliance against abortion. And so the LDS and the RLDS Church, of course, I'm not going to go there. Any anti-abortion people see it as a moral issue, and that's fine. But it's a case of two conflicting moral positions by sincere Christians. One side holds that life begins at conception. Some of these folks go on and say murder. Some even go beyond that and justify murdering abortion providers, even when they're at church. The other side holds what I call the Planned Parenthood morality. They believe that a person or a couple have a moral obligation to bring children into the world only when they are prepared to offer the security and the love that the child needs to be a healthy individual. I'm not saying they have to have money. They just have to be able to offer the security and the love. It's a genuine difference of moral opinion. a reasonable compromise can be achieved. Now let's look at gay rights. Since the Mormon, these are the two, you know, big codification. Since the Mormon Church has been very active on this issue, okay, most arguments against gay rights seem to be religious, often based on a half dozen biblical passages. But these passages really are irrelevant on the issue facing us today, which is, are we going to respect relationships between same-sex couples which are monogamous, which have the same kind of commitment to lifelong fidelity to each other that a typical homosexual couple are assumed to have? Denying a segment of the population the same rights as the rest of society is difficult to defend as serving the common good. But I think it is opposition to gay rights that is really based on cultural prejudice. You know, in my own case, as I was raised in a culture and a family and a church, anti-Catholicism, anti-Semitism, racism, sexism, and homophobia. But the hardest one to break really is homophobia. You know, I was a jock, those big strong guys. We probably had more homophobia than most of the rest of our society. Okay, so anyway, the presumed nomination of Romney raises Mormon questions. The Mormon Church is with religious right in many, practically all of these hot button issues. But as a Massachusetts politician, Romney, as you all know, differed with his church on these two hot button issues. And I think that fact helped reduce possible religious prejudice against his candidacy. Dennis Lithgow, who might be able to add some important information on this. It helped him politically be clearly independent of the church on big issues. But Mitt Romney, I don't see any daylight between him and the church. And one of the most telling points was 4 years ago when Tim Russert talked about the racial policy. And Mitt said that when he heard the change in 78, he was driving somewhere, he pulled over and wept. And I know a lot of Mormons got basically that response. But then Tim pushed him, pushed hard. But was the church wrong before 1978? He refused to say they're wrong. How easy that would have been, and how politically wise that would have been. It was stupid to not admit, yeah, my church could be wrong. And I think that's the most important Mormon issue above all the others I've talked about. The society worried that the Pope would tell John Kennedy what to do, or he'd act inconsistent with Catholic thought. And, you know, the Mormon church is seen as expecting obedience from his people. And if Romney can't show that he's distanced from his church like he did in Massachusetts, then I think it's really a bad situation. And church leaders are not politically naive. They will understand and forgive a presidential candidate for straying from orthodoxy to curry political favor. Now, Sunstone Mormons might have a little harder time getting forgiven for their unorthodoxy. But anyway, Mitt Romney's father serves as a good model, and I'll just leave out my George Romney part here. Because I'm getting pressure from this guy here that I found it along. But anyway, as governor of Michigan, he differed on race. In my opinion, Huntsman's Mormonism was much less of a political problem, but no one was willing to pay attention to him. But I think he was the best qualified candidate, partly because of his more expansive worldview based on his personal history. And I think he's the only 2012 Republican candidate worthy considering in 2016. His knowledge of and appreciation of other American religions and Asian religions sharply contrasts with Mitt Romney. Few, if any, presidents have been as well read in Christian theology as Barack Obama. I think John Huntsman and Obama could have an intelligent discussion of Christian theology, and Huntsman would have a lot to add from his knowledge of Asian religion coming in here. I think Mitt Romney would be in over his head in the discussion of theology with either Obama or Huntsman. Okay, I'll close with some advice. Now, if you're a Mormon and you want to run for high political office, your best bet is to run as a Democrat. You almost automatically differ with your church on some issues. Harry Reid is a good example. Finally, I'll close by saying, I'm Bill Russell, and I approve this message.
Thank you, Bill. Anna Collector, furthermore, will you promise to... we now have about 15 minutes for questions and answers. My instructions here are to ask you to come to a microphone
But there's no, I don't see any microphone. Bill, I'm going to ask you to come up here.
Yeah.
You can take the mic.
I guess, why don't you let me be a
Rover.
Deacon here.
And, yeah. Fine.
It worked. Do that.
Let me
Yes. So if you have questions you'd like to ask Father Bill, now's a great time to do that.
I guess mainly, doesn't it have any religious opinions? Is there any evidence that he does?
Well, I think Mitt is a devout Mormon. Oh, yeah, sorry.
You don't have to. It's in the mic,
but maybe...
We didn't hear
it. Okay. Does Mitt Romney have any real religious convictions? I think he does. You know, I think he'll flip-flop. And I hate to use that word because compromise is so important.
Shapeshifter.
He's a compromiser in politics, but I think he's a devout Mormon. I mean, you know, I don't see any evidence he's not. And if he wasn't, why wouldn't he create some distance a long time ago from the church?
You know, the sad part is that had Huntsman been ambassador under George W. Bush to China, he would have been a hero, but because he was under Obama, people automatically wouldn't even hear one word he said.
That's probably
about on every issue.
Probably true,
You know? The interesting thing, one of the sessions yesterday, they talked about why are the, as people have been persecuted all these years and centuries, why are we the ones that have backed every war more than any group except the Southern Baptists in 1920, whether it's Korea, World War I, Iraq, Vietnam, especially Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Next to the Southern Baptists, we have the highest percent that did that. And I guess LBJ came to BYU and said, we will win Vietnam.
Yeah.
And when it didn't happen, we just turned against the Democrats big time. We said, they're all liars. They don't have a global view that I'm willing to pay the price.
Yeah.
Everything. So another thing I'll comment on, a lot of people told me we got into Prop 8 so we could get more cachet with the Republican Party and other religious groups.
Yeah.
If that's what they thought, it backfired, because the day after the election, I turned on the Catholic radio on the way to work, and they said, isn't it interesting that we were with the Mormons on Prop 8 and we campaigned with them and we donated them and did everything they told us. They didn't do one thing to help us ban abortion.
Mm-hmm.
We lost 53-47. Had they announced in their pulpit to vote for this, contribute to it, have your missionaries walk for it, we could have won this thing 53-47.
Yeah.
So now we've got the Catholics mad at us. I mean, we really are like a bull in a china shop at times.
Well, there's other groups you can still offend, too. They've got everybody. No, I'll add one thing there. I mean, as far as Mormons being more supportive of war, it seems to me that the Book of Mormon, America, the Chosen People, makes you tend to think our government's right when you go to Vietnam or Iraq. And then you add to that the Book of Mormon with all the wars and everything. You know, not surprising the church has been a little more hawkish than the rest.
This is a really wonderful talk, Bill. Thank you. I'm wondering if you can sum up the answer, because it was so much information that I'm not really clear. So how important are a political candidate's religious beliefs?
Okay. They're important, and they're important if they have an impact on on their political policies. But if they can put their religious views aside, say, for example, support gay rights, or use the examples. There's a good compromise position on abortion. Bill Clinton articulated it. Abortions need to be safe, legal, and rare. Now, you know, pro-choice people don't emphasize the rare part enough. But anyway, that's a decent compromise. And I think a pretty large percentage, a large majority of American people are satisfied with that kind of a compromise. This is the guy I said is an expert.
I knew Mitt Romney well in Massachusetts in pre-governorship days.
Mm-hmm.
And I would consider him certainly an orthodox Mormon in every way. And yet it's hard to know how many of his views change because he is flip-flopped on every political issue.
Yeah.
And probably every moral issue since he's been running for office, even beginning with the election against Senator Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've been most curious about is his refusal to really say anything about how he feels religiously, what religion means to him, what the church means to him, to share any of the experiences that he had with his bishop and state president.
Yeah.
And which was, I think, at least bringing them closer to the people that we were trying to avoid.
Yeah.
Issues or doctrines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd love to get your email address and correspond with you later, but I'm going to ask that now. It seems to me there are two reasons why people feel like we just don't know this guy. And that's because there's two things. I mean, he doesn't want to talk about what's really core to his being, that is his Mormonism. So that helped. And I think if he talked about, like you're saying, you know some of those experiences as a bishop, well, later, but experiences as a Mormon semi-leader, if not a bishop yet, when you were there. You know, he did a lot of good things for people in trouble. And that's great. That would be great to talk about. But he doesn't want to do that because that'll raise, you know, baptism of the dead or whatever. Then his other great achievement is healthcare in Massachusetts. And he doesn't want to talk about his greatest political achievement. So we don't know about his political achievement, and we don't know about his religion. That's so important these days. We don't know him. You know, and I think that's his really fundamental mistake. Yeah. I think as far as compromising stuff, he's compromised on his politics, he wouldn't do that, but I think he's basically a core Bill of Mormon, but I don't know for sure. Yeah.
I was intrigued by
this guy knows a lot too.
Dennis's remark, and I'm gonna pick his brain a little bit more because I've long been a follower of Mitt Romney ever since I started doing research on his first presidential campaign back in 2007. And I'm just in the process of reading a book that Bill and I talked about, this new biography, The Real Romney, which I think Bill would agree with me that I think it provides some acute insights into maybe some of the things that you alluded to, Dennis, his extreme caution. I think a lot of it is rooted in what happened to his father in 1968. Tom, you're very familiar with too, because you wrote one of the seminal articles on that. It was published in BYU Studies, Why Romney's 1968 Campaign Failed. And I think he is still haunted by the fact that in 1968, Romney's father, very different kind of guy. I mean, they look a lot alike. You think that the son is a clone of the father in every way because they look so similar. But personality and demeanor, his father was much more of a person who spoke from the gut, from the heart, was not afraid to what he, you know, to say what he believed. He came from a working class background. I mean, he worked his way up, never finished college, anything else. Mitt, had a cocoon existence, growing up a very privileged child, going to private schools, everything else.
Yeah.
Mitt was very enthusiastic about his father when he ran for political office and was a political junkie from the time he was a little kid. He shadowed his father and everything else. And I think when he saw what happened to his father in 1968, he just became extremely cautious, extremely guarded, extremely careful. And that was kind of more of a trait of his mother as well. I think in some respects, Mitt Romney takes more after his mother in terms of being circumscribed, being very careful, everything else, rather than his father, who speaks from the gut. Would you agree with that?
I think everything that Newell says agrees with what I have read. I mean, he's usually not right like that, but I think he's right on this time. Yeah.
There is one.
Keith Norman here.
Yeah, we have opportunity for.
We've got about 5 more minutes, don't we?
5 more minutes.
I was interested in your comment that a Mormon would be better off running president as a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
We learned in one of the sessions yesterday that a poll of active Mormon Democrats, the majority actually were going to vote for Romney because he's one of us. But we have a very prominent Mormon Democrat, Harry Reid, who has an unfavorable rating among active Mormons, at least in the state.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because he's presumably because he's a Democrat. So why is it so hard for presumably Mormon Republicans to consider Democrats as legitimate candidates?
Well, you know, the there's a larger percentage of Republicans in the Mormon Church than virtually any other church, isn't there? I think that's what you say. So your whole church culture, you know, is socializes toward the Republican Party. And if you live in the Mountain West, well then I can see why you're going to end up running as a Republican. But I similar kind of thing with Huntsman and Romney. You know, they're saying, well, Romney's going to get the Mormon vote. And I say, well, fine. Let Romney have the 2% of Americans that are Mormons, and let Huntsman go for the other 98. And so obviously they probably shouldn't, you probably shouldn't move out of Utah. You know, move to a swing state or a Democratic state. Swing state might be better.
Question. Do you think that Huntsman's national political future is tied to the fate of the Tea Party? I got a feeling that Huntsman would have been a very, very... He would have been standing in the center of the big state, the stage of... Mm-hmm. Had it not been for the Tea Party, because certainly from an establishment point, he would have received support. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, if I understand your question, I think a lot depends on whether or not the Republican Party in 2016 is still wanting purity of thought more than, kind of hate to characterize it as thought, but anyway, wants purity of position more than they want to win. The longer you're out of the presidency as a party, the more you're anxious to win, and therefore you're willing to nominate a Bill Clinton rather than, you know, Governor Brown or Bob Kerry or somebody in 2019, or my own friend Tom Harkin from Iowa, 1992. So that's hard to tell if the Tea Party does not do well in 2012 and 2014, then I think Huntsman would be in a lot better shape. Yeah.
Well, last question. I just want to know, around Grand Island, Nebraska, do you still stand by your prediction that Obama will win by 15 points? Do you still stand by that?
Did you forget to put in your hearing aid at the time? I said that this is just sort of a fun prediction that Romney will win the popular vote by 1% and Obama win the electoral vote because he's done better in the swing states than he is in the other. And then Obama will be reelected. And that might lead finally both conservative states and liberal states realizing either side can lose the election they should have won. So maybe we could get a constitutional amendment on the direct popular vote. And then maybe candidates will come to Salt Lake City during they'll campaign based on where are the media markets in the country. And they won't spend all their time in Iowa. Now, I regret that if they don't come to Iowa somewhere. I met Obama three times, gave him valuable advice once. I heard him speak in Iowa five times. But so, we Iowans love it, but it's not a good system.
Well, we'd like to conclude the session now. We'd like to thank you for coming to session 213, How Important Are a Political Candidate's Religious Beliefs. Thank you very much.